Hi, I'm David Crow. Welcome back to The Infectious Myth. Thank you for tuning in to episode 58. Although we're not live today, you can always email me with comments about the show or suggestions for future guests at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. You can like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. We're on iTunes and other podcast programs. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message with your mailing address letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, I will send you a little thank you gift. And if you'd like to support PRN or this show directly, please contact me. Today we will continue our discussion of vaccination by talking with Dr. Jane Donegan, an MD from the United Kingdom. Starting as a mainstream doctor in the 1980s, she started to become concerned about vaccination, concerns that were amplified when she started getting historical statistics and realized that a huge fraction of the deaths from infectious diseases had occurred before vaccination was available. She also became knowledgeable about the nutritional factors that weaken or strengthen the immune system, factors such as low iron and vulnerability to diphtheria, or low vitamin A levels and vulnerability to measles. When she testified in court for two mothers who were trying to prevent their estranged husbands from forcing vaccines on the children, the General Medical Council went after her. But after a multi-year process and a lengthy hearing, they were forced to admit that her views were based in solid science. We will get the benefit of some of her knowledge today. Dr. Donegan is a GP and homeopathic physician. She has a special interest in vaccination and promotes health and practical and supportive children of childhood and adult infectious diseases and other illnesses. She qualified in 1983 from St. Mary's Hospital Medical School in London and works as a freelance National Health Service GP in addition to offering private consultations in North London. Welcome to the show, Jane.
I'm delighted to be here.
Yes, and so when you started as an MD in the 1980s, did you have a mainstream understanding of vaccines that they were safe and effective, and anyone who thought otherwise was crazy?
Well, I did, because I went through medical school and I was told, and this was reinforced by what I'd done in my qualifications before I went to medical school, that people used to die of diseases for which there were vaccines, and then the vaccines were introduced and then they stopped dying.
Right.
We were also told that there were other diseases for which there were no vaccines that people also stopped dying from, but we were told that those were due to improved social conditions. We're supposed to be quite clever, people who get into medical school, certainly
right.
In this country, and you would think perhaps that someone with an inquiring scientific mind might ask, well, if these people stopped dying because of improved social conditions, maybe these people also stopped dying. But basically, the medical curriculum is so crowded that you just learn what you're told. And we learned that these people stopped dying because of vaccines, and these people stopped dying because of better social conditions, and they were completely separate groups.
I think a lot of people confuse medical doctors with scientists, but I don't understand how you could learn so many facts that are prepackaged in a relatively short amount of time and actually treat them like a scientist, like go investigate all of the facts. Like just keeping up with absorbing what you're being taught must be about all you can manage in medical school.
Well, it is. And obviously, it's backed up by papers and it's backed up by graphs. And there are lots of graphs that show, from about the 1940s, that say, well, here were the diseases and here's the vaccine coming in and now fewer people are getting it or dying from it, so therefore it's the vaccine. And if you are some kind of scientist, you do realize that graphs do not show causality. They just show association in time. And what you're supposed to do when you have a graph that shows that something happened and then something on the graph changes, that's what you use to as a basis for a hypothesis for further study to actually show if it is causal. And what we normally regard as causal is a double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled trial, which means you use something that is biologically inactive mm-hmm. against your desired intervention. They both look exactly the same. They're delivered in exactly the same way. They're chosen randomly by other computer generation,
right.
Taking numbers out of a hat. And you don't know which is which, as well as the person you're giving it to, so that there should be no opportunity for emotional overlay. And none of the vaccines that we use in our schedule have had that at all.
Well, one of the things I discussed with my previous guest was that the placebo contains all of the toxic non-biological ingredients. Like if there's mercury or aluminum in the vaccine, they're likely also in the placebo.
Well, it's quite strange reading these papers. You read a paper that is called in its name a placebo-controlled trial, for example, of the acellular whooping cough vaccine in Sweden. And it's the trial results and conclusions are purported to show that this is much less reactogenic than the whole cell whooping cough vaccine, which in fact it is. However, when they state that the people who had the active ingredient had hardly any more side effects than the people who had placebo, well, when you actually look at the placebo, which is what made me first actually look at it, you see that people who, the babies who had vomiting, fever more than 38.5 degrees centigrade, or persistent crying for more than 1 hour after the vaccine, which I can tell you as a parent is a very long time.
Yes, it seems like forever.
Well, no, there wasn't a big increase compared to the placebo, but the placebo had a very high level. And then looking in to see what the placebo actually was, of course, it contained formaldehyde and aluminium and various other things. And
how do you find that out? Because when I read scientific papers, it just says placebo, and it seems to me it never says what's in it. Like, how do you figure out what's in the placebo?
Well, in some papers, it actually does say in it, not usually at the beginning. They'll say in either the précis at the beginning or the discussion at the end, they'll just say placebo, and you have to look inside the actual method.
Right.
Some actual papers don't state it. So, for example, there's a famous MMR placebo trial in twins that was done in Finland.
Right.
And it shows that, I'm terribly sorry about the background noises of
hen. It's okay. It's authentic.
And it says,
we're actually calling the United Kingdom and you can hear the chickens.
And it compares people who are vaccinated to placebo. In that actual paper, it doesn't actually say anything other than placebo. And it's only when I looked and saw how many people who had the placebo who had a severe fever reaction after it that I thought, I must find out what this is. And I looked in the methods and it said, regarding placebo, see a previous paper. So I had to get the previous paper out, order that. And then when I looked in it, it then stated that it had the vehicle, which is basically what the measles, mumps and rubella antigens are in. And in this vehicle were, well, there were things like sugar, but there was also hydrolyzed pork gelatin, monosodium glutamate, and more worryingly, there was an antibiotic called neomycin.
Right.
Now, if you look in the British National Formulary, which in the UK is published by the British Medical Association and the Pharmaceutical Society of Great Britain, it says under neomycin, not for parenteral administration, that means by injection.
And yet it's in the vaccine, parenteral.
And the thing that was in it was phenol red. Now, I didn't manage to find much information about phenol red because there are no studies on carcinogenicity, teratogenicity, or toxicity. It's generally used for as a pH indicator in swimming pools. And out of what it does say, people working with it can have increased problems with respiratory illness.
Phenol red is
a... Like it wasn't something that needed to be in a vaccine.
Right. It's a dye, and is it maybe
it's
put in the air,
yeah,
so that if the pH of the vaccine goes wonky...
Well, I don't know if that's why they use it in the vaccine. They don't actually say why they use it in the vaccine,
right,
but that is why it's used in swimming pool management.
Yeah, I recently read the list of ingredients of the current MMR2 vaccine for Merck, and it's incredibly long because it includes three vaccines, each of which have their own ingredients. So there's a lot of different things. Obviously, it's small quantities, but it means like if something goes wrong and you have a reaction to the vaccine, you have no idea. Are you allergic to neomycin, or is it phenol red, or is it the pork gelatin, or what? How would you know?
Well, one of the problems with this idea that they are only small amounts is, yes, they are only small amounts. But if you think, for example, about the dietary advice for small babies that before the age of 6 months, they're not supposed to have unmodified milk or citrus or wheat or nuts, and you're not supposed to give them salt because their kidneys can't manage it, that sodium chloride. However, it's all right to give them vaccines that have, in the case of the dead vaccines, aluminium. We can't handle sodium chloride, but aluminium salts are okay, and formaldehyde, and neomycin injected in with a BCG vaccine, MMR vaccine. And it just seems to be you don't have to be the world's greatest scientist to wonder if this might be slightly problematic. And as you say, if there is an allergy, how would you know what it was to out of all the mix of ingredients?
Yes. And
not even looking at the organism that you're putting in, that you're trying to make the antibodies to.
Well, not only that, but I mean the prohibition for babies, it's supposed to be exclusive breastfeeding for at least 6 months with nothing else, like not even water is supposed to be added, right?
Yet,
vaccines are not ingested where your stomach can filter out a lot of the stuff, but it goes directly into your blood system, blood supply.
Yes, a lot of people say, well, this is not true. It doesn't go into your blood supply. The vaccines are subcutaneous or intramuscular. But anybody who has had a vaccine will know that after the vaccine they bleed, because it's not an intravenous injection, but every part of the muscle in the skin has small, tiny blood vessels, and it does have direct access to the blood. However, there is one vaccine that has had a correct double-blind placebo-controlled trial that was randomized.
Okay, and which one is
that's
that?
That's the vaccine for tuberculosis, the BCG vaccine.
Right.
And in the 1970s, the Indian Medical Association and the World Health Organization organized a trial in 250,000 people in southern India.
Right.
The results were written up after several years in the Indian Journal of Medicine, which is not widely circulated in the UK. But all the major journals carried the results, including ones like The Lancet. So in 1980, The Lancet said, more bad news from India. The BCG vaccine is not so effective as we had been led to believe. Well, from my point of view now, from where I was as a medical student, just taking in what people said and looking at graphs and not looking further in, now I don't believe anything that anybody says about anything, particularly when they quote something.
Yes.
So I got this Indian Journal of Medicine article out of the British Library.
Right.
I read all 120 pages, and what it actually shows is that more people who had the BCG vaccine got tuberculosis than the ones who didn't.
So it was actually counter-effective.
Which actually, to me, looks slightly less effective than not so effective as we hoped.
Not so effective. Yeah, that's putting a new twist on it. But to go back to the statistics, because you pointed out that if you look at the statistics around the time that the vaccine was introduced, for a lot of diseases, you see a drop in cases after the vaccine, which is, as you point out, that's not proof, but it's compelling, especially to people who aren't that familiar with statistics.
Yes.
But you've gone back in history, back to the 1800s in some cases, correct?
I did. When I first started looking into the vaccine issue, and I must tell you, it was very worrying for me as a medical practitioner to think that, A, there might be something wrong with the vaccines, B, they might possibly not work, and C, you might have to face these diseases yourself. I was very scared because if you only have a conventional medical training and you just know that you've got this immune system, there's all these germs outside, it might be okay, but it's completely random if it might not be.
Right.
It is very scary. And a lot of people who go and talk to their health provider come away feeling very scared. And the reason that they feel that is because that is how their healthcare provider is feeling about their choices.
Right.
So I was thinking at this point, I had young children myself, I was thinking, well, if the vaccines are not necessarily what protects us and maybe that they have problems with them, how am I going to protect my children? And I'd looked at these books that were not written by medical doctors saying, you know, but all these people used to stop dying before the vaccines were introduced. And I thought, you know, I've been to a top London medical school, I've had top London professors teaching me, I've done postgraduate pediatrics, I've worked in the community, I've counseled people who didn't want to vaccinate their children with what was then the problematic vaccine, the whooping cough vaccine. I thought, if I'm going to go seemingly against everything I've learned, I need to get the data myself. So I rang up the Office for National Statistics in London, and I said, could I have graphs of deaths from all the diseases against which we have vaccines since we started collecting the records? And they said, well, we have them for tuberculosis and smallpox, but we don't have them for the rest. We've got them from the 40s. And I said, well, yes, I have them too. They're in all the textbooks. So they said, well, try the Department of Health. So I rang them up and said the same thing. And they said, well, we've got them from the 40s. And I said, yes, I know, I have your books. And they said, try the Office for National Statistics. So as it was becoming a bit circular, I rang them up again. And I said, look, you must have the data. And they said, oh, yes, it's all here in the books. You can come and get it. It did cross my mind that it was a bit strange that with all the people around doing BSCs and MSCs and PhDs, that I was the person who was going to go and extract this data out of some books and make them into graphs.
It's
anyway,
actually pretty incredible. I mean, we're already in the...
In the information superhighway type of age.
Well, we're in the 80s, right? So at this point? So
yes.
We have...
No, we're 1996 by now.
Okay, so we're in the internet era.
No, we have internet. Well, I didn't have it, but people had it.
It was starting, yes.
So I went in with my two young children to the Office for National Statistics, and I pulled out all the Motti books from 1837, when the Victorians first started recording these statistics, up until 1899. And then after that, thankfully, there was a very expensive, very unuser-friendly CD-ROM that I could at least buy and take home.
Right.
And I started making graphs myself. And then looking at graphs from something like a whooping cough, you see that the incidence of death came down hundreds of percent before the vaccine
right.
was actually introduced sporadically in the 50s and as part of the universal childhood vaccination scheme in this country in 1961. And that's for the whole population. Now, not looking at the whole population, but in under 15-year-olds who are, and these are the people that most parents are worried about in
right.
terms of vaccination, should we, shouldn't we? I used the figures from Professor Thomas McEwen because he'd already done the graphs. Now, Professor Thomas McEwen was Professor of Social Medicine at Birmingham University, and he was also a former chairman of the Health Strategy Committee at the World Health Organization. So, you know, he's a proper person. And in his graphs, it shows he shows that between 1868 and 1953, there was a roughly 98.5% decrease in under 15-year-olds dying from whooping cough. And that's before the whooping cough vaccine was introduced at all. And you see the same with measles. My graphs for the whole population show a massive, massive decrease before 1968, which in this country, a year after you in the United States, introduced measles vaccine. And in the under 15-year-olds, Professor McEwen also shows that the death rate went down from the middle of the 1850s from about 1,000 per million population to virtually zero by the mid-1960s before the vaccination was introduced. Now, this is not showing there's an intervention and something changes. This is just showing that people were stopping dying.
Right.
When I look at figures, I particularly look at deaths rather than incidents, because
right.
the incidence of disease is actually quite slippery because it depends on your level of suspicion as a doctor. And quite often we make clinical diagnoses. So, you know, for example, if somebody has a bit of a cough and they vomit, if they're not vaccinated against whooping cough, you'll say, oh, that's whooping cough. And if they
right.
are, you'll say, oh, it's a cough. And the same with measles. If there's an outbreak of measles like there was recently in the UK, in Wales, anybody who had a rash then, they'd say, oh, that's measles.
Right.
That's why only a third of the cases that they reported were actually confirmed. But if you're in somewhere like London, where there isn't a measles outbreak, you'll say, oh, it's a non-specific viral rash, because the fact is that as doctors, we're not actually very good at distinguishing between red spots.
Well, I was born in the 50s, and I asked my mother, did I have measles? And she said, well, of course you did. Everybody had measles. And I said, how did you know when I had spots that it was measles? And she said, well, there was measles going around. So I said, okay, so all the other mothers were calling it measles, so you called it measles.
Yes, yes.
And
well, I mean, I come from the generation, I was born in the 50s, and when I was little, I was taken to measles, mumps, rubella, and chickenpox parties so I could get them in the holidays.
Ah, right.
And not be ill during term time. That's just how mean my parents were.
Right.
And so I didn't miss any school.
I had a brother and a sister, so I didn't need measles parties. I got
yes.
everything at various times.
Yes.
And
yes.
very rarely got more than one day off school because my mother worked, and it was really inconvenient for her. So
yes.
as soon as
right.
my spots were a little bit less visible, I was back off to school again.
Yes, covered in a cardigan or something.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so you do see that there was some other factor other than vaccinations
right.
that was making people stop dying. So whenever you see a change, either an increase in deaths from or illness from some disease or some infectious agent, or a decrease in deaths, you have to ask what it is. It's one of three things. It's either the disease is changing, the organism is less
right.
virulent, meaning, or more virulent, in terms of virulence means how likely you are to cause disease.
Right.
The host is changing, mm-hmm. they're becoming more vulnerable, or they're becoming more disease resistant, or there's some outside factor.
Right.
So everybody says, this is the hygiene hypothesis, oh, it's because we cleaned things up, you know, there was clean water, we walled in the sewers, we started burying the dead outside of towns, you know.
Right.
The Victorians were very good. They used the money that they had from empire and slavery to do lots of good civil
back home
engineering improvements in the UK. And the problem with that hygiene hypothesis, from the point of view of people who are saying, well, vaccines are the way to go, is that, or anybody who's intelligently questioning it, is, but what is it that stops you from getting the disease after you've either had it or been vaccinated? And this is the whole thing to do with antibodies, because right. what you get from a vaccine is antibodies, that's
right.
it. So it sounds very nice and touchy-feely and, you know, to say, oh, we had all these great social improvements and so people stopped dying. And in lots of cases, the disease incidence went down, so it seemed to be less infectious or less people got it or less
right.
people had clinical symptoms. But how can that be? Because the only thing we know that, or we think, that stops people from getting diseases is having antibodies, because you had it before or you had the vaccine.
Right.
But this is one of the problems with most of our understanding of immunity, which is we talk about the antibody response as the be-all and end-all, and
mm-hmm.
yet this is just the tip of the immunity pyramid. So if you have a pyramid, you cut and you
right.
cut in three slices, the first two-thirds are what is called innate immunity.
Okay.
So the bottom third is the physical foundation. You know, you have skin, keeps things out.
Right,
you cut
right.
it, blood, washes mm-hmm. it out, then it clots, so nothing else can get in. There's saliva, tears, sweat. They have antibacterial properties. There's an
right.
enzyme called lysozyme that busts open bacterial cell walls. We have nice bugs living on us that stop nasty ones from overgrowing.
Right.
If you throw dust in someone's face, they blink. They have
right.
tears. They
mm-hmm.
sneeze. They
right.
cough. They produce mucus. You know, these are all non-specific things. You don't have to have immunity to something or have met it before. You
right.
just get the stuff that shouldn't be there. Some people have too much of it, but everybody has acid in their stomach, hydrochloric acid, that sterilizes their gut.
Well, even the sense of smell, right? Like if you're going
oh, yeah,
to drink
you
something,
smell bad, you stay away from it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and if you eat stuff that isn't quite correct, you know, you have diarrhea and vomiting. That's
right.
an expulsive way of getting things out.
Right.
And that's the bottom basis of that's what our basis is on. And then the middle one, there are internal things. You know, if the organism manages to get into your air or gut passages past all these other, the snot and the
right.
acid and the sneezing and whatever barrier, there's secretory antibody, IgA, immunoglobulin A, that wraps things up in the air and the gut passages. There are iron levels that can change, you know, raising the iron levels. If you have diphtheria, it's problematic if it's a toxigenic, meaning it makes a toxin, diphtheria.
Right.
In order to do that, it has to be infected with a little virus called a phage to make it produce the toxin.
Right.
The virus will only infect it in low iron levels. In fact, this fact is used in the manufacture of the vaccine. They stir up the diphtheria bacteria in big vats with low iron so that they will, in fact, be infected with the phage and
right.
produce the toxin. So changing the iron levels is something the body can do. And then we have non-specific white cells called macrophages.
Mm-hmm.
Big eaters, they just go around hoovering things up that shouldn't be there. So that's the next third.
Right.
And it's only of all these things in the bottom, which are the largest, because it's not really two-thirds, the bottom part of the pyramid don't actually manage to stop it, that you have to invoke the top bit of the pyramid, which is the specific immune system, which is characterized by, A, it makes antibodies, and B, it has a memory.
Right, so that's reacting to
yeah.
a specific outside object as opposed to just
as
a generic.
To everything. So
right.
what all the sanitation measures and the social hygiene measures affect are the innate or non-specific immune system that just
mm-hmm.
make you healthier. And these are the things that make you more disease resistant. If you get the disease, you have a better course of the disease. And when you make your antibodies, if the antibody part at the very tip is needed to be invoked, you make better quality, longer-lasting antibodies than someone who's on the edge of malnutrition and starvation.
Well, I mean, possibly we could add a new bottom to that pyramid, which is your environment. Because if you're like a child worker in a coal mine who's not being fed properly, you're in the environment that you're in, if that changes, if they ban child labor, which they did...
Oh, well, yes, of course that makes a difference. I mean, love makes a difference.
Right.
You're talking about doctors being scientists. Well, we're not scientists. Medicine used to be an art. And the
right.
patients were a lot happier when it was. But now we think we're scientists, and things like love, which you can't measure, we discount, even though we know, for example, that a baby who has no one interacting with it for the first few months, even though it has nothing wrong with its brain, will end up being having a a learning disability, unable to sit up or interact or even crawl, because that's how much human babies need love.
Right, and if the issue of breast, the difference between feeding breast milk and breastfeeding, where breastfeeding is a physical act of love, right? Like the baby is being held while you're feeding, and if you feed it out of a bottle,
even if it's breast milk, it's not so good.
It's not the same thing. Yes, I understand.
Never mind that in breast milk are antibodies that, for example, untrigger the polio virus.
Right. Okay. So, England. I mean, I don't know if a lot of our listeners are outside England, but during the 1800s, there wasn't a lot of rights for workers. England was industrialized. A lot of people were in cities living in slums. So you believe that the gradual increase in the rights of workers, better nutrition, things like that, were what reduced nutritional deficiencies and caused people to be more...
Well, yes, in fact, when you actually read about the conditions of workers in the UK in the 19th century, there's a famous person we all know from Marx and Engels. When he was a young man, came over from Germany, and he went over and he looked at what it was like in Manchester. And when he describes the conditions of workers living on a slope going down to the river, which was full of sewage and mist, and it's very cold in the Midlands and very wet in the winter, there were no paved streets. People lived 13 or 14 to a room. They'd have a fire in the middle of it. There were no lavatories. And when it rained, in the street that you had to walk along, there was the rain, there was the mud, there were the feces and the urine, and the poor diet and the bread and the tea and the continual dampness and the wet and the lack of adequate washing facilities. And when you, never mind the industrial conditions in which they worked,
right.
And when you read about these conditions, you don't ask, why did so many people die? You say, how did anybody manage to stay alive? It's a real tribute to the human body that people manage to survive that and bring up families and go on to the next generation. But it does explain why there was such a massively high incidence of infant mortality and people dying young.
I mean, you can easily understand how a baby under those circumstances had a pretty low chance of surviving, and what to us would be go to bed for a day with a bit of a fever might be fatal in many cases.
Well, yes. I mean, that's what fever hospitals were like. You would admit the child, and if they could be admitted and could afford a hospital in some of the hospitals in London, and the nurses would nurse them, and after a couple of days they'd get to their crisis, and then they'd either live or die, and that would be it.
Right.
But you see, a disease like measles, which the death rate had come quite down from, in the 1940s, the GPs, the family doctors in the UK, were saying, well, you know, we used to worry about measles, but now, even if you get a complication, like pneumonia or something, you know, we have antibiotics and things, we don't worry about it anymore. In developing countries, measles is still a killer, but
right.
These are in countries where people are drinking sewage, they have not enough to eat, they live in damp or underventilated housing, they might be orphans, their parents might have HIV, they might be in a war zone. And if we were in those conditions, not in our well-fed Western state, not
right.
in winter, but if our children were there for a while and lost that much weight and lived amongst that much feces, but
right.
actually it would actually take us quite a long time to lose our Western immunity. But if we were there for a long period of time,
right.
and our children would succumb as well, because that's what the conditions are like. I mean, for example, in the former Soviet Union, in the 90s, when they broke up, they had this massive diphtheria outbreak. It was so large and in so many states that a whole team from the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta went out there
mm-hmm.
and studied them, and their studies took up a whole supplement of the Pediatric Infectious Disease Journal.
Right.
And looking at the whole situation and how it was, their basic conclusion was that it was diphtheria vaccination rates in under 3-year-olds going below 97% that triggered this epidemic.
Nothing to do with the social circumstances.
No, that's what they said. Even though the highest hit and death rate was in 40 to 50-year-olds who had all been vaccinated, with a good quality vaccine, with more doses than were in the US and the UK schedule,
right.
and the fact that when people left there incubating diphtheria into other countries in Europe who had the same immunization schedule, i.e. they should all have been having waning
right.
immunity if that was the case. They didn't trigger off new epidemics.
Right.
Now, there were writers there, like, for example, Professor Artur Galaska, who worked for the World Health Organization, who, amongst this conclusion, would also say, you know, most of the adult patients were alcohol users, a large number of homeless people spread it, stress and anxiety. His colleague, Dr. Zikard Dittman, also from the World Health Organization, talked about socioeconomic instability, population movement, deteriorating health infrastructure, and so on. They mentioned those in passing. But they have a lovely graphs that will show, you know, nice high diphtheria vaccination rate dips, cases of diphtheria zoom up with the maximum incidence and death rate, most of which were in older people, in 1995. However, if you go and get graphs from the World Health Organization for other diseases, you will find that in 1995 also the deaths from heart attacks peaked, the deaths from strokes peaked, the deaths from tuberculosis peaked, and the deaths from syphilis peaked. So you could actually, by that token, take the graph that shows the diphtheria vaccination rate in three-year-olds going below 97% to show that that caused the increased number of deaths of syphilis.
From heart attacks. Yes?
Because if you just look at one single thing, like one part of the elephant, and, you know, with your blindfold, and you don't look at the rest of the elephant, you just don't realize what's going on.
You were saying that diphtheria is associated with low iron status?
Yes.
And does alcoholism cause reduced iron levels?
Well, alcoholism usually, because it's got lots of calories and takes up a lot of your money, usually means that you're not eating a very good diet, because A, you can't afford it, and B, because you have the calories from the alcohol, you're not that hungry. Being an alcoholic usually, unless you're quite a rich one who eats well, means that you're going to be deficient in lots of vitamins and minerals, particularly the B vitamins and iron. And certainly there have been outbreaks of diphtheria in the United States, in the famous Skid Road in Seattle.
Okay.
Where there were outbreaks in the 70s of people who were alcoholic, homeless, living on Skid Row, having cutaneous, which is a skin form of diphtheria.
Right.
They concluded at that time that one of the things you need to do to stop you having diphtheria is definitely to have good personal and environmental hygiene, which was not really what they had in the 5,000 odd people living in Skid Row at that time. They tried to do big sanitation programs. They vaccinated everybody around. Most people who already had diphtheria. In people under the age of 20, 80% of the people who had the skin diphtheria from Skid Row had the full complement at that time of diphtheria vaccinations. And there were other outbreaks amongst Native Americans and other people in Washington State and other places where they had the same type of social conditions. So what I think, for example, about diphtheria is, in this country we say, oh, diphtheria's gone and it's because of the vaccine. But I think if we had the same type of social breakdown as they had in the former Soviet Union, then a lot of these diseases, both vaccinatable and non-vaccinatable, that we have got rid of, would rear their ugly head again, because it was social conditions improving that got rid of them in the first place.
Well, it seems like we're heading in that direction with the increase in inequality in society. We could easily end up in a few years with a group in a society that have so little resources that their children are severely malnourished and starting to succumb again, which will mean people run around with needles and vaccinate them more, but it won't make it go away.
No, well, I mean, that's one of the problems in all these lovely charitable initiatives that we do in developing countries. We go along with our vaccines and we say, here we are. If there are studies showing that, you know, if children live in improved housing made from fired bricks instead of wattle and daub on the edge of rivers, and they with a concrete foundation and a pit latrine in somewhere like Malawi, that they will have reduced respiratory and diarrheal and malarial illnesses. You know, we don't have a vaccine for malarial. That makes the malaria much more malaria-resistant.
Right.
People who have low albumin concentrations, that's an indication partly of how much protein you're having, and body iron stores, have much higher incidence of rheumatic fever in Bangladesh. Even in Vietnam, just a nutrition project where they got people to do little home gardens reduced the incidence of pneumonia and severe pneumonia and diarrheal diseases.
And measles.
We all know, well, at least I hope you all know, that if you have a higher vitamin A level, you're much more resistant to measles.
Right.
And then we go out giving vaccines, and the vaccines are not cheap. People say, oh, but, you know, you're talking about changing the whole structure of society, and that's very difficult, and it's to do with the person's own government. So we'll just go in with what we can help with. But when you look at the billions of dollars that are spent on these vaccines, if we just spent that money on enabling these countries to give everybody a clean water supply.
Well, it's funny. Yeah, you mentioned growing gardens. I remember reading a paper from South Africa where they taught, they had a study where they gave some women in the village tomato seeds and got them to grow them, and then they measured the vitamin A levels in those families, which of course went up. But they also used as a control the rest of other people in the village, but they noticed that the vitamin A levels in the rest of the village went up as well, because what was happening is they were producing so many tomatoes that
they gave them to their friends.
Yeah. And it's such a simple intervention, and it's really based on education, that it's some of these things are really easy to grow in certain climates, and they're very nutritious, and it seems like a no-brainer, and probably cheaper than the vaccines, and something that continues to grow in the future, whereas vaccines only, every year you got to come back and stick needles in people's arms.
Yes. In terms of vitamin A and red and orange and yellow colored vegetables, the World Health Organization knows and says in its paper, its mission statement on measles, when it's discussing it, that yes, vitamin A levels help. And of course, then what doctors do, instead of looking at projects like giving people tomato seeds, they say vitamin A helps. We'll give people vitamin A. So they give them a certain amount of vitamin A, and that makes children in developing countries more disease-resistant to measles and come out of it much more healthy. And then they say, well, if a little bit must be good, then a lot of it must be better, and we can give it less often. This is artificial vitamin A, not tomato.
Right, right.
Then they give them massive doses once or twice a year and kill children.
Just
before realizing that actually you can't give doses that high because it's a fat-soluble vitamin, and you won't be able to excrete toxic doses of it.
Right.
So even when we know these useful things, the way health is delivered is all to do with drugs instead of common sense.
And also, I mean, a tomato doesn't just have vitamin A. I mean, I think there's a real reductionist approach to nutrition where we don't want to deal with the fact that a tomato probably has 300 nutritional chemicals in it, and although vitamin A may be the most important, the other stuff is also important, whereas vitamin A given directly, that's all you're getting is the one chemical.
Well, that's what we've done with our very pure modern pharmacopoeia, which is we've taken a lot of plants which have alkaloids in them, which are chemically active and biologically active, and we've said, so, for example, the tomato's got vitamin A. Of course, we don't get it from tomatoes anymore. We synthesize it. Because we say, look, there's all these other stuff in the tomato that doesn't matter. Or there's in the cod liver oil, there's all these other things. They're not biologically active.
Right.
And the same with Artemisia, which they have been using for thousands of years in China against malaria. They say, but, you know, this is artemisin. That is the active part. So we'll just give people that. And what they fail to realize is that in a plant, there are lots of other chemicals in them, and roughage and structure and so on, that are not what we call biologically active, but they are enablers. So when they are given with the biologically active thing, after all, they were designed by a fairly clever creator, you know, to be together in one thing, okay? And they're there for a reason. And so if you have the vitamin A with all the non-biologically, as we see it, active parts of the tomato, or the artemisin plant, or whatever, artemisia plant, they have a bigger effect. So in the case of the malaria with the artemisia, they have now synthesized artemisin. It's a drug. And almost within a couple of years of being used, there's massive resistance to it. Because when it was given as its whole plant form, stewed up in a tea, it had all the extra bits with it as well.
Right.
We keep doing this time and time again.
Yeah, it's the modern error, like try to find the one thing that works. And then
that you can patent, yeah.
The patent system is a big problem. So I wanted to talk about what happened to go back to sort of the beginning when I was asking you how you when you started to become skeptical of vaccines. Like, you got some pushback from the medical system in the UK about your opposition to vaccines or skepticism about vaccines.
Well, I acted as an expert for two mothers who didn't want to vaccinate their children.
Mm-hmm.
And they were taken to court by two absent fathers. They weren't related. The courts just decided to amalgamate them because they were similar
cases. Right.
Two absent fathers who wanted them to be vaccinated. And they couldn't find anybody to be their expert. And originally they weren't going to have one because the legal aid board that pays for, that helps people who can't afford to pay their legal fees here under very stringent criteria, said they couldn't have an expert because no expert would agree with them, even though the legal aid board obviously is not a judge. But the judge said, no, this is nonsense. They must have they must have an expert, and you have to pay for it. So the mothers managed to find experts and people who were willing to act as an expert in the UK who weren't medically qualified, so the legal aid board wouldn't pay for them. And they managed to find medically qualified people outside of the UK who the legal aid board also
wouldn't pay for. Yes.
They wanted a UK doctor.
Right.
So I am an expert in vaccination with the amount of work I've done on it now, but I wasn't an expert at being an expert witness. But I'm Irish, and so we understand about the downtrodden.
Right.
And so I don't like to see social injustice. So I said, well, I'll be your expert then. I looked at the reports from the other experts in the case, one for the fathers and one for the children, because the children being minors had to have their own legal representation.
Yes.
And they're about two or three pages long. They basically said, you know, the diseases all kill you. The vaccines are all safe and effective. They need all the vaccines. And I thought, you know, the mothers are already being thought of as being, the word we use in this country, sort of bonkers.
Right.
You know, they don't know what they're talking about. So how am I going to make it so that somebody could have a more balanced understanding of this case? So I thought, well, I'll have to write a story. I'll have to talk about what the diseases are like and how you treat them, what they were doing before the vaccines were introduced and what they've been doing since the vaccines were introduced, what the manufacturers say are the adverse reactions, because the manufacturers do say there are adverse reactions, and basically how a healthy child would cope with these diseases if there was a likelihood they might even get them, because for some diseases there just isn't a likelihood anyway.
Right.
And so I did that, and I meticulously put in all my references. And one of the things I did, which has informed all of my investigation, is that when I get research papers, there are no good, balanced, reasonable, scientifically adequate papers looking at vaccination, really.
Right.
But there is a lot of scientific literature, and if you look into it with your fine-tooth comb, you can find lots of information, particularly looking at the science, which is the method and the results. You know, because if the method's no good, the results are pointless.
Right.
And then when the results, if the method's good and the results are good, you sometimes find that when you get to the conclusion, it doesn't really reflect the results.
The conclusion's in the abstract.
And unfortunately, a paper that came out in 2004, after I'd done all this, from the British Medical Journal, actually said that. It said, do not look at the abstract or the conclusion. Only read the methods and results, because the conclusions by authors often don't reflect what they have found in their experiments. Anyway, I did my papers, and when I showed information from papers, I wrote what I found in them. I didn't state the conclusions. One of the things I was heavily criticized for was, in fact, not stating the author's conclusions, because the barristers were implying that an author's conclusion was a bit like a finding in a court.
Right.
It isn't. It's just somebody's opinion. Anyway, so I went there. I talked. The judge admired what he called my my honesty, which... I don't know how he expects people normally to behave, but he wasn't impressed with what I was saying. So the mothers did not win their case, and in the adversarial system. And when they went to appeal, the appeal judges, who had never heard me speak and had not heard what they called my disarming honesty, they called it junk science. And on the basis of that, the authority that regulates doctors in the United Kingdom, which is the General Medical Council, accused me of serious professional misconduct. Which meant they would take my license to practice away.
Right.
And that was, the first case was 2002, the appeal was 2003, and this was 2004.
Right.
To cut a long story short, after a very long process of 3 years, during which time my defense team had thought I was fairly harmless, if not a bit odd, in their opinion, but they would defend me because I'd paid my subscriptions. Actually, at one point, decided that they couldn't defend me at all, because when they saw the General Medical Council Council's expert's report, Dr. David Ellerman, they said they'd never in all the time that they had been defending doctors ever seen a report by a doctor about a colleague that was so critical and so scathing and because he was a consultant at Great Ormond Street, which is the premier children's hospital in the country, the panel would be so impressed that there is no way they could defend me. So what they've done is a deal with the General Medical Council that so long as I agreed to all the charges, then, and that I had been guilty of professional misconduct, then they would keep my registration. This is sort of 2.5 years on, and I can't emphasize, or I can't really exaggerate how big a toll this took on my family life.
Yes.
And so at that point, I was left a bit stunned, and I thought, but you know, I've always said to them, what was important to me was not my registration, but my reputation, because
right.
What's the point of being allowed to practice as a doctor if they think you're that weird woman who doesn't know what she's talking
about?
Yeah. They didn't actually accuse me of lying, but they might as well have. So I just asked for a second opinion, and then 6 weeks before my case, my whole medical team, all the barristers and the lawyers and everybody, withdrew, and I was left with nobody. And then, thankfully, I managed to find a lawyer called Clifford Miller.
Yes, I know Clifford, yes.
Who, he's not a medical lawyer. He is a patent lawyer, but his expertise is seeing the detail.
Right.
Which is what you need as a patent lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
Then, thankfully, my medical defense organization took it on, and he managed to get it shifted to some months after that, restate the whole case. And in the end, after a three-week hearing in August in Manchester, it's very interesting.
Of which year?
Of 2007.
Okay.
If I had taken out the wrong kidney of somebody and they died, they would have probably heard my case in a morning or a day.
Right.
But because I had said that there were other things than health that you could do than vaccination, that it wasn't compulsory in this country, and if two parents couldn't agree and they were separated, I thought the person with day-to-day care should actually make the ultimate decision.
That makes sense.
It took 3 weeks. And even though the GMC, the General Medical Council, is based in London, and I live in London, and I'm a single parent home educating my children, they made me go up to their office in Manchester for 3 weeks. So just sometimes people wonder why doctors who might have some misgivings about vaccination don't speak out, and I can tell you there are plenty of good reasons.
Yeah, sounds like it.
But at the end of this three-week case, I still can't believe it, the panel found I hadn't failed to be independent, objective, and unbiased, and that out of all the experts who were there, everything I said was based on medical papers and backed up by references. And although I had made some mistakes in the context of four experts, eight statements, and hundreds and hundreds of references, I'd made fewer mistakes than everybody. And so I'm actually the only doctor in this country whose opinion on vaccination has been tested in a three-week statutory UK legal tribunal, found to be objective, independent, and unbiased beyond any doubt.
Well, I mean, I'm surprised, because I would have thought you would have stood a better chance in the legal system where they don't have all the prejudice about vaccines. But I guess the people in the legal system have absorbed the propaganda, so they see this as black and white, and don't bother me with all these statistics from the 1800s. What does this have to do with anything?
Well, the thing about the legal system is that it's adversarial. We have this naive hope that it's about truth, but it's not. It's an adversarial system, and the point of a good barrister is to make the other side look like an idiot. And you have to be pretty good to not look like an idiot. And you have to learn things. It's very pressurized. They'll say, just say yes or no. And you sort of think, oh, I must say yes or no, even though obviously it's a gray area.
Right.
It's not until you have more experience that you realize that you can say, well, actually, I can't say yes or no. It's a gray area. And it sounds like very small things, but it's an adversarial system, and it's made to be that one person beats the other. The one who has the best team will win.
Right.
And
do you think
there is also the pressure, obviously, there's a big political pressure not to rock the boat in terms of public health policy.
Right.
But, of course, one of the things that's always forgotten when we get into the legal arena, which is definitely not the place to make decisions about families, is particularly to do with vaccination. It seems that every registered body wants to support the Department of Health's public health scheme.
Right.
But of course, the public health is looking at herd immunity. It's not looking at singular immunity. So the policy made for a whole country might be based on what is thought by them to be best for the whole country. But I don't know about the law in the United States, but in the United Kingdom, the Children Act says that it has to be in the best interest of that particular child. And of course, if you have a particular child and they're not less than 1 year, and you know they're 4 or 5 or 9 or something, you know, the whooping cough is irrelevant. There's no polio. There's no diphtheria.
Right.
Are for anybody who's over the age of one, you know, can manage a dose of measles. You know, so while they're supporting public health policy, they're actually veering from what their job is in terms of looking at the best interest of that particular child, because their risk and their social surroundings might mean that they're not really at risk from the disease at all.
Yes, and I don't know what it's like in the United Kingdom, but in the United States, the number of vaccines that are being given to children has dramatically increased over the past 10 or 20 years.
It's gone up exponentially. I mean, it used to be that you'd get the triple, diphtheria, tetanus, whooping cough, and polio, and you'd get that at the age of 3 months, and then you'd have 2 whole months to recover. The next one was 5 months, and then you'd have 5 whole months to recover. That was 10 months. And then when you were 12 to 15 months, you get a single measles vaccine.
Right.
And now we start off, people get BCG at birth. In the United States, they get hepatitis B at birth.
Right.
And then the actual vaccine schedule starts at 2, 3, and 4 months.
Right.
Except it's a 5-in-1, because it includes the hib. And then you either have the meningococcal C or the pneumococcal one as well. So it's far more. And then when you actually get to your first year, you don't have a measles vaccine. You have a measles, mumps, and a rubella vaccine.
Right. I just see that with the increase in the number of vaccines, that the increase in side effects is going to grow exponentially as well. And I mean, at some point, it gets to the point where people just can't ignore this anymore. I don't know how they ignore it now.
Well, I don't know how you can... Well, I know how you can say it, but I don't know how you can really hope that it will get any better, because I can't see an awful lot of hope. For example, the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, irrespective of what you think about autism and anything else.
Right.
There was one form of it which had a strain of mumps vaccine called Urabi, which was definitely associated with mumps meningitis. It was used in the United States. It was used in Canada. It was withdrawn from both of those countries because of the unacceptably high incidence of adverse reactions. And
right.
You have to realize they're quite big for somebody to pull a vaccine.
Right.
After it had been withdrawn in both those countries, the United Kingdom used it in their MMR campaign that started in 1988. And when the cases of mumps meningitis, mumps vaccine strain meningitis started being reported by labs,
mm-hmm.
not all the labs, only the ones that were looking for it, and they reported these findings to the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization, they didn't do anything about it. Their main worry was that if they started saying anything about it, it would dent confidence in the vaccine. Also, it was a cheaper vaccine, and anyway, it wasn't very many people being involved. The reason it was eventually withdrawn was partly to do with manufacturers, because they could see the lawsuits lining up. And even when it was withdrawn, the concern of the vaccine committee that's supposed to be enabling our health and the health of our children was sort of, how do we cover this bad news day? You know, if the manufacturers, if it's no longer going to be available, how do we cover why it's being withdrawn? And on a radio program, I think it was in the 90s, the editor of the Bulletin of Medical Ethics in this country, Dr. Richard Nicholson, spoke to a Dr. Mike Watson, who was the spokesperson for the UK pharmaceutical vaccine
right.
industry. And he said to him, you pharmaceutical vaccine manufacturers, you say you're working in the best interest of children, isn't that right? And Dr. Watson said yes. And he said, so could you tell me, please, why it is that after the Urabi-containing MMR vaccine had been withdrawn from the United States and Canada and the UK, that you cynically sold it to South America for their MMR vaccination campaign and produced a predictable epidemic of mumps meningitis? And he said, oh, well, it was just a bad headache, and they all recovered. However,
wow.
the only child in this country who's had a payout for MMR vaccine damage was damaged as a result of the encephalitis he got from the Urabi strain of the MMR vaccine. So he's 23 with the age of a 3-year-old and can't do anything himself.
I've seen several of these cases documented in the United States, YouTube videos or whatever, and you see this child who's obviously 10, 12, 15, 20 years old who's got the level of a toddler, can't talk.
The argument always is, well, they got whatever they got, and a certain number of people in the country get that anyway, and the fact they just had a vaccine the day before, it is irrelevant. Now, I'm a doctor who's looked into vaccination. Why do other doctors not see it? Well, there's one doctor in this country who was asked by a Sunday magazine, a Sunday newspaper, to sort of do an expose on the MMR, you know, show that people's concerns were not important, you know. And he went off, and as a result of his investigations, he ended up, he was an NHS GP, offering, when they were available, on the NHS single mumps, measles and rubella vaccines. He also discovered about mercury in vaccines. So when the vaccines in the schedule here were mercury, he was offering mercury-free ones because they were available. And when the wholesale whooping cough was the vaccine that was still recommended here, he was offering the acellular one, which we use now. It's not great, but it's an awful lot better than the wholesale one.
Right.
In terms of adverse reactions. So he's a doctor who went and looked. So it is there if you go and look. And one of the things I do think about my medical colleagues, there's a lot in this country to do with money. You know, people say, oh, the GPs only want to vaccinate because they get paid for hitting targets, which is true. But most of them have the opinion that I had before I started looking into it, which is that if you don't vaccinate your children, you're ignorant. And if you are not ignorant, then you're sociopathic, because otherwise, why wouldn't you do it?
Right.
What I do think in terms of criticism of my colleagues at this level who are just doing what they think is the best thing for their patients is that there is so much controversy to do with vaccination. I do think they ought to go off and do some work themselves. It doesn't take very long. You know, an intelligent parent going on the internet, which, you know, we're supposed to stay away from, but not very long, just looking at the PubMed, you know, where all the scientific papers are published, database, or looking at some sites and then following up their references by looking in PubMed, can educate themselves fairly quickly in a few days. And I don't think it's beyond the remit of doctors to be able to do that as well. But I have patients, for example, who have had videos of what they looked like before their MMR, you know, bouncing on contact, then videos afterwards showing a shell of a person.
Right.
And they are being seen by a consultant in a London hospital who says, I will treat them for their developmental regression and their bowel disease, but if you mention the word MMR, I'll discharge them from my clinic.
Wow.
Okay. I've had people after a HIV vaccination whose child has had meningitis, and the doctor on the ward has said, well, I think it's definitely due to the vaccine, but I can't write it in the notes.
It's really sad. We've unfortunately run out of time.
Yeah. Anyway.
This has been a wonderful conversation, and I really do believe that education is the solution for both parents and for doctors. It's unfortunate that too many doctors believe everything that was in their medical textbooks at university. So thank you very much, Dr. Donegan, for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Okay, goodbye.
Bye-bye.